So think about this lottery ticket that you talked about is a dice with around 1 trillion sides. It's impossible to imagine, but if you roll the dice and it lands on a zero, you win.
That is the coolest, the best way I've ever heard the difficulty adjustment explained. That's amazing. This episode is brought to you by Club Orange, where Bitcoiners meet. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Nova. Today I have Michael Schmidt here with me, and this is a great episode for you to actually wrap your head around what Bitcoin mining actually is. So thank you so much, Michael, for joining me.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. My name is Michael, or people actually know me more under the name Schnitzel in the Bitcoin community. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not from the US. I grew up in Switzerland, lived there for around 25 years, and then I moved to the US where I live now since a couple of years. I have a software engineering background, and I, funny enough, heard from Bitcoin actually quite early on. So we're talking like 2009, 2010. The problem is I had no idea how broken our monetary system is at that point. And then really like in 2020, 2021, learned a lot more about money in general, how broken our system is, and then jumped into the mining space again. Because as I mentioned, I do software during the day as my day job, but as a balance, really my night job, my weekend job is playing with hardware, playing with Bitcoin mining, and figuring out these days, how do we actually reuse the heat? So my whole house is heated with Bitcoin mining. My water, my pool is heated with it. And we're working on open source projects that allow other people to build something very similar.
I love that you're open sourcing it. And that's what Bitcoin's all about. You build something and you share it with the world. That's all about decentralization and what Bitcoin is. And that is amazing. The heat punk movement, as people call it. And if you're spending money already on electricity for heating your home, why not earn some sats and pay less for the electricity? It's a great movement and it's a great great idea. What other ways can you implement Bitcoin?
Anything that's like, I really encourage anybody, like, walk through your house and think about what actually heats up. Obviously the water heaters, but even the dishwasher has another water heater inside. Your clothes washer has another heater inside. Your dryer actually as well. There it's not hot water, it's hot air. Then obviously any type of cooking, any type of convenience heat, like if you have a little space heater in a room, or let's say if you have kids and you have bottle warmers or milk warmers, all of them in the end technically could be replaced by Bitcoin mining. Or if you have a pool, or if you live in a very cold climate, people have like driveway heater or sidewalk heating. And so yeah, that all of that technically we could replace, because in many, many cases, specifically if you heat with electricity already, the Bitcoin mining will not use more electricity. The only difference is it's going to give you some sats back, as you mentioned. I would claim there's really not many cases where it doesn't make sense if you already heat with electrical to replace it with Bitcoin mining. And then the other fact is the fact that they are KYC free, which specifically, right, it's becoming harder and harder to actually buy Bitcoin completely anonymously. And mining is almost the only way to do it.
I love that. And can you explain, since this is an episode explaining mining, what KYC free is and the benefits of doing that?
Very good point. Yeah. So usually if you go to any exchange and you buy Bitcoin, you're going to have to start with your identity. So you have to take a picture of your passport, of your driver's license and whatever. So that means the exchange that converts your, let's say, dollars into Bitcoin, they will know who you are. And while they all claim that they will not give that data to anybody, there's a reason that the government forces them to collect that data. And specifically, if you talk about very high amounts, there is actually automated reporting to the IRS or any other tax authorities of your country. So that means, right, that the government and people will know that's you. You own that much Bitcoin. And because, and we're going to talk about this, Bitcoin is a public ledger, I can actually follow that money around. So I know which Bitcoin that, let's say you, Stacy, if you buy $100, I will know exactly on the public ledger that they're yours, or not me, but the exchange and the government will know that. And so that's obviously very bad. And we have seen cases in the past where this actually was bad for people. And so if we say KYC, which means know your customer. If we say KYC free, it means that nobody knows that you own this Bitcoin. And with Bitcoin mining specifically, and how mining works, and we're going to get into this, the Bitcoin that is generated through mining has not your name or your ID or your passport number attached in any way. So these Bitcoin are the purest, the rawest Bitcoin you can get that are not in any way connected to your identity. And some people really put a lot more value on that because they say, right, they don't want the government or any exchanges to know how much Bitcoin I have and what I've used them for.
And for people that think that doing it this way is like you're trying to evade the government, that means that you are not a fan of cash. You know, so because all these years, cash has been peer-to-peer, you know, the government doesn't have all this information. They don't know who gave who what cash. You tip people, nobody knows about it. So cash is the way that we've transacted for all these years. So yeah, it's just a digital version of that system, of the peer-to-peer cash system. So it's not something where you're trying to sneak around and evade the government. That's where I think people have a misconception.
Correct. Yes. And there are, though, other ways how to get KYC-free coins, but it usually involves of actually like transacting peer-to-peer than transacting Bitcoin in person. That's one other way. And so people are seeking ways of getting KYC for Bitcoin, and mining is one of them.
I've seen that at my local meetups. There are people who have homesteads and farms, and they bring either bread that they make or eggs or maple syrup that they press. I don't know what the word is for the maple syrup process. I'm like, but they, you know, they bring these products and things to these meetups. So being able to create something of value for the world and be able to trade that for this digital cash. So I love that it's this circular economy that's happening in these local meetups.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So now that we know about the reason why mining is great, can we get into the Bitcoin mining aspect? What is Bitcoin mining?
Of course. Yeah. No, I'm happy to. So I always start at the very, very early beginning. And I'm an engineer. So right, for me, it's important to understand how something works or why does it exist. And I'm always using the reference of like, let's think you and I, we want to transact some kind of money or some kind of monetary value. Let's say you're a farmer and you want to sell me some of your eggs. Today, how this works is that if I want to use money and we don't barter, that we have a central entity, right? The government in this case, or today with fiat and the banks, there are central entities where I can say, hey, I'm giving $10. Now, it doesn't matter if I do this in a bill or a digital, like let's say through Venmo or whatever, I send that to Stacy or physically give it to you. And this works because, right, we have central entities that we both of us kind of trust. Now, some people trust it more, some people trust it less, but even if you transact with dollars or Venmo, you actually put your trust into this entity that the dollar that you receive from me, you can use it again to buy something else, right? If I just take a piece of paper and say $10 on it and give it to you, you wouldn't trust this because you put trust inherently into the green paper or the Venmo and transaction. What we've learned as humans that over time, central entities are obviously, they have an incentivization to actually start to cheat. And every society had that. And if you go back, if you read history books, you see this pattern again and again, that as soon as a central entity controls a good, they will start to just cheat slightly bit, right? We've seen this with banks that initially they had to keep all the gold for all the dollars that they handed out. And then they were like, why? Like, nobody's going to need all the gold anyway. Let's just give out more dollars. And that was where fractional reserve banking was created. And we as Bitcoiners, we believe, right, that's a bad thing. Because in the end, it shifts the incentivations away from the good of everybody to the good of just individual entities.
To pause there real quick, it's when you think about it, that you were saying that green paper, you know, people trust the green paper, but it's the green paper that is printed by that central authority. And it's funny how if you counterfeit that green paper, it's illegal, but they do it all the time.
Good point.
They're always
bringing
more, and they can't, you know, nobody can stop.
Correct. And so if we want to create a system where you and I, where I can send monetary value to you and we don't want to use a central entity, We could technically, one solution is that we have a global ledger, and that's basically, just think about it, a notebook where it says in it, Michael right now has a value of 10, or let's say $10, or it can be 0.0001 Bitcoin. It doesn't really matter what we agree on, what the unit is. And if I say I will give $10 from my account that I own, I want to give it to Stacey's. If there would be a way that I can update everybody's notebooks, right? Everybody keeps a little notebook of all the transactions of that ever happened. If there would be a way to do that, we would have a decentralized system. Because whenever I transfer some money to you, every notebook, every ledger in the world gets updated fully automatically so that when you in the afternoon, let's say, go somewhere else and you want to spend that $10, the person that will receive your $10 that you want to give them, their book or their notebook, their little ledger would also be updated. And that's how decentralization works. The problem is we're talking about a global system of 8 billion people at the same time. And so that makes this a little bit like, while theoretically a perfect system, that doesn't work. But that's technically the approach of Bitcoin is we're saying, or the Bitcoin network is that instead of having central entities, we give everybody every transaction that ever happened. So if you want to check if Michael has the $10, you can just look at all the transactions that I ever did. And if overall I received more Bitcoin than I spent, you can see there, oh yeah, you have that value and then you can transact it. Now, obviously, right, we cannot give 8 billion people from one second to the other a ledger of all the transaction ever. So how we do this is that we basically have computers. So we call them nodes. In the Bitcoin network, they're called nodes. And you can run one yourself. It even is now possible to run some of them on our phones and devices we carry around with. But basically what they do is they keep every transaction ever. Yeah, a start 9, that's one of them, which I have running next to me as well. I'm looking at it and it's blinking. And it tells me that all is fine in the Bitcoin network. But that's basically what we do. Like, it's this simple approach of just giving everybody every transaction ever. And computers are obviously really good. The problem is, and that's actually where physics comes in, is synchronizing these transactions is quite complex, right? Because people in Australia do a transaction and let's say in the US at the same time. Now, the speed of light, while being extremely fast, it still takes a couple of milliseconds to go from the US to Australia. It's just because it's such a long distance. And so doing decentralized synchronization of multiple millions of these nodes that you should, like these little computers, again, is extremely complex. This is my background. So I've been working in decentralized software, and I can tell you that's one of the most complex things we're trying to do, is to basically synchronize these millions of computers that at any point in time, they have the exact same information. And so there's a problem there that we need to solve. But that's how at least the Bitcoin network works, is that we have all these centralized nodes that have all the transactions ever synchronized, so that ever at any time, all the time, we can know who actually has how much value.
It's constantly verified.
Correct. Yes. And so a solution to this real-time problem, right? How do I synchronize multiple continents with each other? Is instead of saying, let's synchronize it all the time, let's just synchronize it every 10 minutes. And how this works is that, so all these transactions, since the beginning of Bitcoin, they are actually put into so-called blocks. So every 10 minutes, we create a new block. And a block basically contains all the transactions within the last 10 minutes. So instead of, if I want to send $10 to you, Stacy, instead of me saying, I do this right now, and then all the ledgers have to update right away, I just send it and Bitcoin calls this into a temporary block, you could call it. Bitcoin calls it the mempool because it's the memory pool. That means these transactions have not been actually what we call confirmed, or they have not been put into a block yet. They just exist for some specific time.
So when you call it that, Bitcoin keeps it in that mempool.
Yeah.
That means that all the computers running the Bitcoin network that are confirming the transactions, like you sending your Bitcoin to me, it's it's like a pretty much a few computers around the world will say, yes, this happened, but it sits there in this mempool.
Correct. Yes. So how it technically works is I send my wish to transact $10 from me to you to a node that I'm connected to. And the node says, thank you. And it will send it, the node sends it to its 10 other nodes that it's connected to. And these 10 send it to everybody else. And these 10 send it to everybody else. That, again, that takes a couple of seconds to go through all around the world. But that's okay, because while they're inside that mempool, they're not actually transacted or confirmed yet. They're in this in-between state. But what this in-between state, or the mempool state, allows us to do is that all these nodes, they have time to catch up. And then if one of the nodes actually finds a block, and we're going to get there how this happens, the node says, I will just take all the transactions that I've seen at that time, I put them all inside a block, and then I transmit the block to the network. And now
I have a really good comparison.
Yes.
Thinking, is that like when you play Tetris and all these pieces are coming down and then you get a line and that line goes away?
Yeah, you could look at that. Yes. It's basically right. Instead of trying to synchronize all these transactions all of the time, you just agree that we say, okay, we do a window of 10 minutes. We take all the transactions in there and then they are a block. Now, it can obviously happen that the node that found the block hasn't seen your transaction yet. And that's okay, because the transaction will then maybe arrive just a couple of seconds later, and then it will then basically add it to the next block. Oh. But this 10 minutes solves the problem of the real-time synchronization. And that's with a global network all over the world through the internet, through satellites and through really bad, like some people even do this now, through ham radio waves and all that stuff. It allows it physically to actually be possible. And that's what we call, that's where the word blockchain comes from. So every time that we make a block, we're not only just, so the block consists all of the transactions in that specific block, but the block also points to the previous block. And so basically all these blocks, they all point to the previous one, and that's where the blockchain comes from. There is a technical capability that you have multiple chains, but that goes a bit too deep into an introduction of all of this. But just what you need to think about is that they basically all point to each other, so that I have this transaction, right? Because we need to remind ourselves, we do this blockchain to make sure that I actually can prove, hey, me as Michael, I have $10 to spend, and I can send them to Stacy. And after that transaction goes first into the mempool, stands there probably for 10 minutes, and then gets confirmed into a block. At that point, the whole world will know Michael now has $0 and Stacy has $10, or Michael has zero sats and Stacy, let's say, has 100,000 sats.
And when you say confirmed into the blockchain, the confirmation part of that word would mean encrypted, and the chain part of that word would mean that it is immutable. Because when people say those words, it's when you add it to that chain, it encrypts, you know, so it has this security layer and it's immutable, because when it's part of that chain, you can't go back and change something because you would have to change everything previously.
Correct. Yes. So the immutable part comes from the fact that while, let's say we do the transaction and it goes into the block right away, it's not, at that point, it's still immutable. It still would be possible that two people find a block at the same time, right? And they both point to the previous block, but my transaction is only included in one of the blocks. That actually happens sometimes multiple days in the Bitcoin network, but it's meant to be, like, it's built resilient. The immutability comes from the fact that the new blocks 10 minutes later are being found. And then these point again, right? So the block that my transaction is in it, let's say it's block number 900,000. And then there's another block, then block 9001, 9002, 9003. And because they all point to my block at one point, and as this chain gets longer and longer, the fact that somebody else randomly finds another 900,000 or a block with the number 900,000 that my transaction is not in it, it gets extremely small to impossible. And so therefore, yes, that's where the immutability comes in. But that's also why some services, you've maybe seen this, if you send Bitcoin, let's say, to an exchange to be converted into fiat again, sometimes they tell you have to wait for confirmations. And that's basically the exchange understanding how this chain works. And they just want to wait 3 or 6 blocks, so 30 to 60 minutes-ish, after you made your transaction, just to make sure that me as a bad actor couldn't randomly say, I was like, oh, no, I actually never did this transaction type of thing. That's where these confirmations come from, and that's the immutability.
Yeah, so each confirmation would mean each node says yes, 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 and it just keeps sprinting saying they all agree. Right.
Correct.
So that's what each confirmation.
Correct. And every block on top of it, right? So every block is a confirmation on top of that, and all the nodes, correct, they also verify. And that's also where the encryption comes in. It's not so much encrypted, so the block themselves doesn't have any encryption in it, but what it's doing, it uses cryptographically verifiable information. So, right, with cryptography, you can encrypt something, and that means I cannot read what you encrypted unless I have the key. But there's also capabilities to verify that something is correct. And that's what's happening in these blocks. So all these blocks, they actually have been hashed. And that's where we're going to the mining world a little bit. So these hashes, they verify that all these transactions together are correct. And that block or that hash inside that block makes sure that, yes, not just randomly somebody could go in and change something. Because with a hash, if you change even a tiny bit of a data, the hash completely changes. So that's the cool thing about hashing. So I couldn't just go into a block and saying, oh, I'm just going to, right, because this is a network where all the nodes work with each other, I could technically go in and just tell my node to send out a block that suddenly says, oh, Michael received 10,000 Bitcoin from Stacy. Even if I would do this, I would create such a fake block and I would publish that. The other nodes around would say, no, because your hash, your cryptographic hash is not correct. They would actually refuse to accept that block. And that's where the security of the cryptographic system comes in. Because again, correct, in a bank or in a central system, I could go to the bank teller and saying, does Stacy has this amount of money? And that bank teller would look in the database. In Bitcoin, we don't have that. So we need a way to basically keep this all secure. And that's what we use cryptographic verification for.
That's really great. So cryptographic verification. And then I had a really great question coming up to that, because I was thinking about the cryptography and, oh my God, I'll think of it next. But I wanted to, if I come back to that idea, I'll share it. But I wanted to see if when you go from this part of the conversation, do you go to the part about them guessing that lottery number?
Yes.
Or is that, am I skipping a bunch of
stuff? No. We're on the path there. Yes, correct.
A quick word from our sponsor. Bitcoin isn't just something we talk about online. It's about real people, real friendships, and real communities being built in real life. And honestly, you don't know what Bitcoin friends are until you have them. And then you can't imagine not having them. That's what Club Orange helps make possible. Club Orange is a great app for Bitcoiners. It's an awesome way to meet new friends in your surrounding area who share the same like-minded interests in Bitcoin. And when you're traveling, it makes it easy to see who's around you, find local Bitcoiners, and connect wherever you are. It's also a great way to discover Bitcoin events, meetups, conferences, merchants, helping us build the circular economy through real-life connection. And with Club Orange, sharing sats with friends and groups has never been easier. Download Club Orange today and click the link in the description for 21% off your membership. Club Orange, the Bitcoin social layer where Bitcoiners meet.
So the next problem is, right, so we now have a decentralized network where anybody in the world has transactions, they have this ledger, they have these blockchain, they synchronize, we solve the problem of the speed of light. So we're actually really close. The issue is now, okay, how do we generate such a block? Right? Because if the whole world wants such a block, how do we make sure that it only happens every 10 minutes? Because in the current system, imagine the system we just built, anybody can create a block and just publish it. So what would happen is that everybody in the world would create a block, let's say every second, and they would all send it out. And we would have basically the same problem as we had before, where everybody just sends transaction all the time. And as mentioned, this synchronizing such a system is impossible. So Satoshi found a really cool way to enforce that we have a block only every 10 minutes. Because this system, right, it only works if we have only every 10 minutes. Now, if we would have a central system again, you could just have a central system that says, okay, the first block in the morning, Michael is allowed to mine, and then Stacy, and then Tom, and then Alice, and then Bob. But we don't have a central entity. So we need to find a way how we decentrally, without the central system, says you, how we can, among all the people in the world, figure out a way to do something that happens exactly once every 10 minutes. And that's actually one of the fascinating things of the Bitcoin network. And we do this through mining. So how does this work? So as I mentioned, in Bitcoin or in cryptographic verification, you have these hashes. And think about the hash. It's a 64 long character long number. And every time, so if I take all the transactions, and I take them all together, like all the transactions are currently in the mempool, and I run a hashing function over it, the hash that comes back is a, from me, from my point of view, it looks like a completely random 64 character long string of numbers and letters. If I change one single transaction or just one single number, so if I just add a zero, if I flip a zero to a one, that hash looks completely different. Like in our normal math, in our brain, we would think, oh, it would only change maybe and also a one to a zero at the beginning or at the end. But how these cryptographic hashes are set up is that if you change a tiny piece, the impact is very, 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 very big. And Satoshi figured out this, that it is mathematically possible to predict how fast such a hash is found. And how the Bitcoin does this is that it says the hash has to start with a specific amount of zeros. So think about this 64 character long number. If you say, I want the first 10 of these 64 characters to be zeros, I can predict how many guesses that it takes me, let's say one person would do all this hashing, how many of these lottery tickets or guesses that I need to do until I find a hash that has these 10 zeros at the beginning. And I know that sounds crazy, but it is mathematically possible. And that's what the Bitcoin network does every single day. So because think about, let's go a super simple case. Think about you have a dice that has six sides, right? If I ask you, how long will it take you until you roll a six? What would you say?
I would say four tries.
Four tries, okay. But if you do it 100,000 times, how much do you think it would rather, like if you try every single time, how many is in between?
Oh, how many between each try?
Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, 100,000 times.
Yes.
So how many times you'll get a six?
Yes.
Oh my God. Probably like 40,000.
Something like that, yes. Now just think about, now you have two dice. How long does it take you now? Or how many would you roll? It's
two,
double, right?
So yeah, like, double. So yes, 80,000.
Correct. Yeah. So basically, if you know how many sides of a dice that or how many sides the dice has and how many dices you have, you can, and if you know how fast you roll, you can predict or by average say, this is how fast it will take me, how long it goes. Like if you have six dices and you want a six and you roll all of them at the same time, the chance that one of them is a six is very high. If you have 24 dices, it becomes even higher and higher and higher. And that's the same that the Bitcoin network does, just with the difference that the dices have like 10 trillion sides. And in the world, we have probably 500 million of these dices that all these computers are throwing. But that's basically what the Bitcoin network is doing. So think about this lottery ticket that you talked about is a dice with around 1 trillion sides. It's impossible to imagine. But
right.
And if you roll the dice and it lands on a zero, you win. And if you win, that means your Bitcoin node is allowed to create the block. So it's allowed to take all the transactions, put them in a block. You're going to have to show how many times you rolled because that's how other people verify that you actually did the work or not. That's what we call proof of work, right? So there's a way for you to actually prove that you did indeed find the right throw, or in the Bitcoin mining, it's like you found the right hash, and then you're allowed to publish it. And if you know the Bitcoin network, basically every 2 weeks, that's the difficulty adjustment, it basically checks how many in the last 2 weeks, and it's not actually 2 weeks, it's the last 1,000-ish blocks, it looks at how many dices were there and how fast did the people roll the dices. And if you know that, you can predict how complex the dice needs to be so that for the next 2 weeks, roughly every 10 minutes, a block is found.
That is the coolest, the best way I've ever heard the difficulty adjustment explained. That's amazing. So you just, you just take that trillion-sided dice and make it 2 trillion sides if it's double as fast, you know, if it's getting faster to mine. That's why we will never get to the last Satoshi mined until the year 2140.
Correct.
That is amazing.
Yes. And it's really cool, right? Like, and people are always worried about, oh no, what would happen if half of the Bitcoin network would go away? All would happen is that after, well, yes, for some time we would find blocks every 20 minutes. But then when the difficulty adjustment comes, the Bitcoin network looks at it and says, like, oh, we've lost a lot of dices. Let's make the remaining dices much simpler, right? It's the same. Think about if you have 4 dices and you want to roll a 6, you roll all 4, it goes pretty fast. If you lose 3 of them and you have only 1 left, it takes you much longer. But if you want to find a winner, let's say every 3 throws, you can just say, okay, now the winners are from 3, 4, 5, and 6, right? So you not only need to throw a 6, you can just also, if you throw a 5 and a 4 and a 3, you're also a winner.
So that's why when computers are running the Bitcoin software, so when you have these Bitcoin miners, they're running the software, they're earning Bitcoin as far as, okay, I'm using this much energy and I'm earning this much Bitcoin. It's the exchange of energy versus the exchange of dollars on an exchange. But then when you have companies who want to, or companies or people who want to have many, many miners, and companies can have many more miners than individual people, they have so many more dice. So
correct.
It's very interesting to think of it that way.
Yeah. So think about, right, if you use a BitX, just think about it as 1 dice. You buy 1 dice and that you have a chance. Mm-hmm. And there is a chance that of these trillion sides, there is that you roll the right number. Mm-hmm. Now, these really big Bitcoin miners, all they did is they don't buy better dice because there are not any better dice. It's like it's mathematically defined. They just buy a lot more, like you just mentioned.
Yeah, I also wanted to have you explain then, besides the people, because the lottery miners at home, that's just like buying a dice, but the people that have the actual, like an S19 miner or something like that, those are actually earning Bitcoin based on the energy. But what you're talking about is the block winning. So when you win a block, can you explain
So as you mentioned, this dice rolling costs a lot of energy. And so the question is, right, why would people do this? Why would people buy computers that in some cases cost multiple thousands of dollars, connect them to energy that each of these miners use hundreds of dollars of electricity every single day? Why would somebody do this? And Satoshi again figured out that you have to give them an incentivation. And that incentivation is that whenever you find a block, you're not only taking all these transactions and put them into a block and transmit it, and you can claim, hey, I found the block, right? It's a huge honor, at least, if you find a block these days. He realized there needs to be some monetary incentivation, and he actually added 2 of them in there. The first one is, you can give yourself Bitcoin out of the void. So every block today in 2026 that is found, when you found a block, you can give yourself 3.125 Bitcoin for free. So that's basically the reward, the fact that you had all these dice rollers and all the energy that was in there, or you had all these Bitcoin miners, you get the reward for that. Now, keep in mind, when we started with this in 2008, it was 50. Then every 4 years, it halves. So that's what people call the halving. So basically, every 4 years, that reward becomes smaller. So we start with 50, 25, 12 and a half, 6, 3. In 2 years, we're going to be at 1.5-ish. And so that's basically, and the reason that it becomes smaller is that Satoshi realized that at the beginning, this network is brand new, right? Nobody's going to trust it. So you need to give people a lot more incentives. Then later on, if the network, now that the network has existed 18 years, like it's a much more understood, so you actually need to give people less. But today, of the current Bitcoin price of, let's say, $70,000, $80,000, and for every block you found, yeah, you make $200,000 to $300,000 you just get for free by the Bitcoin network. There is another one, there's another incentivation, and that's people are asking, well, but if it halves, right, there will be a time that there's zero Bitcoin that I win when I find a block, and that's correct. That is in 2140. So all of us that are alive probably will not experience that. But at that point, the miners are not allowed to give themselves any more Bitcoin. However, the transactions themselves also have a transaction fee. Because, like I mentioned before, when I want to make a transaction, it needs to go into a block. Now, these blocks, they actually have a max size. So you cannot just make blocks of any size. So if there's currently, let's say, 100,000 transactions waiting to be confirmed that are in this mempool, I can actually, as a miner, I can only take around 3,000 to 4,000 transactions in a block, because a block has a size. Now, the question is for me, how do I choose of this pool of 100,000 transactions? How do I choose only 4,000? And that's where the fees come into play. So when I make my transaction, so I want to do $10 from my account to Stacy's, I can say, hey, I want to attach, let's say, 1 cent of transaction, or I can say 10 cent, or I can say a whole dollar. And obviously the miners have an incentivation to take the transactions with the highest fees, to take them first in. So it's basically like a queuing system where I can pay to be upfront. Right? If you ever went to Disneyland, everybody knows how this works. You can pay to go to the fast pass, the fast lane, and the same system we also have in the Bitcoin network, that I basically pay more. And now the miners, they're always incentivized to take all the transactions, so they have the highest amount. And so all together, that also gives me some additional reward, or it gives me the transaction fees, we call them in mining. So that as a Bitcoin miner, when I find a block, I not only get the 3.125 Bitcoin reward, but I also get all the transaction fees. Now, today, we're talking about maybe a third to half a Bitcoin max of transaction fees. However, the game theory is that obviously the Bitcoin price is going to go up more. So even if we stay at a half a Bitcoin, this is going to be a lot more worth. And also because the block space is also scarce, right? So it's not only the Bitcoin itself that we have 21 million, but the block space itself is also scarce. So people are going to pay more and more money to actually be part of this. And so that's the other game theory behind all of this, that the Bitcoin miners, they're getting paid for their electricity, they're getting paid by the transactions and also Bitcoin network itself to actually do that work. And all of this we do actually because this secures the network. So the fact that there's so many companies out there that spend all this money makes Bitcoin a lot more secure, because if I would want to attack the Bitcoin network, I would need to spend more or the same amount of money to attack the network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true, because the network is decentralized, global, humongous, and it has so many computers working that you'd have to spend. That's why they say it incentivizes attackers to just mine Bitcoin, because it's too expensive. But I love the idea of thinking about the future and how those transaction fees, if you think about it, like you said, how much now per block could be gained in transaction fees compared to at the end of this, when the last block is going to earn, what, 1 sat or something? Like, is that how it's going to, I forget how it works at the very end. So when that last sat is earned, as the halvings happen and less of a block reward gets given to the winner of this lottery, it's going to be more and more valuable as time goes on. So that, just thinking about that is mind-blowing, because that 1 sat could be worth who knows what, or I don't know. At that point, we're not going to even think about dollars, or people that are alive then won't be thinking about dollars. It'll be probably just Bitcoin. But then you think about how whatever those fees are going to be very valuable. Mm-hmm. So people transacting on that main blockchain would be the most wealthy people, because then other people would use Lightning. It's hard to imagine.
It's extremely hard, right?
Yeah,
the other. The other thing we also need to understand is how much will energy cost in that world? Right? So that's like in 100 years. If we look at the evolution of energy and the capabilities we've gained over the last 100 years, if you try to project, who knows? Maybe we actually have a very, very cheap money. If we have more world wars, maybe the energy is actually very expensive again. So that's it. Then the next question is, how good are these miners? And that's the other thing. At the beginning of the Bitcoin network, like when I started in 2009 and 10, you could literally just run your notebook overnight and the next morning you have 50 Bitcoin. Now you need to buy, like if I would try to do the same with my notebook, it could run for 100,000 years and it would never find a block, right? These chips that we have, we call them ASICs. And because they're specifically only done for Bitcoin mining, they cannot do anything else. They are so highly optimized that one of these chips is 100,000 times faster than my computer ever will be. And all of these are factors into what's going to happen. And of course, like you mentioned, is how much is the Bitcoin network actually used? What people put value behind? Will fiat still exist? And like, there's so many factors that we don't know. But that's the beauty of the thing, right? When Bitcoin started, a lot of people had questions like, oh, this is never going to survive more than a year. And here we are, right? 18 years later, and it's still kicking. So, yeah.
Yeah, just to think about how in your journey, you started off mining and you probably had no idea what this even was. You probably just thought, oh, I'm just playing around with some technology thing. And then you came back to it later and seeing how it's changed over the last 18 years is, I mean, just being there from that time, trying to mine and doing, you know, that is wild to think about. And just seeing the change. So just trying to project that forward is something that you can't fathom.
I mean, there were people that claimed, like already in 2009 and 10, that this will become the monetary global standard and whatever. And I can tell you, these people were all last out of the room because just nobody believed that the world will adapt open source digital system. Like, we didn't even have like phones or smartphones. We're just like this was the time that these things started to happen. Like, people couldn't even imagine like that we have now like computers that are more powerful and these times on our wrists now. Like, all of this just was about to happen, and somebody standing up and saying, oh, we're gonna use this as our base for the global monetary system, that's just like, no, like the chance just was so tiny that this ever happened. But there were people that already believed that, and I think, some of these people I still meet, and they definitely don't need to work anymore, so yeah.
Well, that's why it's wild when you think about Satoshi and how secretive he was and how he hid his identity from the very first moment he spoke about the white paper in those emails. The amount of paranoia that he had.
Yeah.
You know, to even think this could work or will be adopted. And it's just, I can't even still understand it. I mean, I know everybody, like, that's part of the mystery. And how did... if nobody else believed, or even if you did start to believe, everyone thought you were nuts.
Yeah.
And then as it's growing, it's crazy to think how far the network has come and how it's being used and adopted. And that's why just thinking about that creator or whoever that group or person was, to just be that careful.
Yep.
Just even thinking that this might be the way.
And also understand, right, so much in so many different fields from that we just learned Bitcoin mining. It has a lot to do with physics and how energy systems work. Then decentralized databases, right? That's his whole field. You can do a PhDs about decentralized databases, and then the whole monetary aspect and financial system. So yeah, whoever, him, her, they, whatever this group was, had a lot of knowledge on a lot of different things about humanity, like as a whole. And so I think, yeah, it's fascinating that they came up with a system that is such, like, so powerful and self-regulating. Like, that's for me the beauty of the system, right? You could literally, like, all of us could go away. Like, that's the other crazy thing. Imagine all of humans would get wiped out for whatever reason. The Bitcoin network would continue to work. Like, as long as there is energy, this system will just hum on and it will just make blocks and it will update each other. So there are these, sometimes, like, if my with my friends and Bitcoin miners, we will like talk, okay, imagine all of humanity gets wiped out. For how much longer will the Bitcoin network run? And there's some people say this will run forever.
I'm blown away by that idea, because you never really think, I mean, I've never gone there, and my mind goes in crazy directions.
Self-custody means guarding your seed phrase, your password to your digital vault. Stamp your seed phrase onto durable titanium washers. The kit includes stamping tools and a hammer and a simple click system that makes the process super easy. And you can create as many copies as you need. Visit microseed.io and use code NOVA for 10% off your order.
But yeah, just thinking about the fact that, I don't know, birth rates dropping, humans having kids, will that, you know what I mean? Just certain ideas that people have and about how there might be more, even as humans get older, they might do the whole turn into cyborgs, like upload themselves.
Who knows? Freaking,
you know, yeah. And then will there be a lot of organic humans being born? And will that, you know what I mean? Like, will the world, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but again, just theoretically, sci-fi movie speaking, if the world turns into a robotic future, then these robots, you even ask AI now, what currency does it prefer? And it prefers Bitcoin. It doesn't prefer cryptocurrencies of all kinds. It prefers Bitcoin because it is the only one that doesn't have a central authority and is unchangeable. And that's what AI prefers. So AI, robotics, future, you know, you just think like they could use this as their... That's a wild thought. That is crazy.
And it's like it's similar, right? Like for me, when I grew up, the internet just became a thing. And we still had like modems that you had to like put your actual phone, like phone headset, like you had to push it into foam to connect to a modem, to a computer. And even there, people already said like, oh, this will become the standard of communicating. But people are like, no, like, how can you imagine this? This is a crazy idea. And look, 25 years later, where we are, like, we have a communication in real time through the internet with video and everything. My whole company or other people that I work with, some of these people I've never met, and I'm working with them every single day. And it's just like, it doesn't take a lot of time. And I think that's in general, like, us humans... It's funny, we're very good in overestimating what we're achieving in 1 or 2 days. Like you ask people, like, what are you going to do in the next 2 days? And they're telling you all these things. And usually they achieve half of it. But we're very bad, or we usually underestimate what we can achieve in a year or in 10 years or in centuries. And I think that's what's going to be, right?
Especially with the exponential growth curve of technology. I mean, I still remember in high school, I think it was, I got my first iPod and I showed it to my dad and he's like, you can hold 1,000 songs on here. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, isn't that crazy? And then now you could just stream every song ever made on a phone that does a million other things and has AI on it. You know, it's like, who would have ever thought?
Yeah. And now take that and multiply it by 2 or 3 times. Like, we cannot even imagine what world we're gonna live in, whatever. But I think to bring it back to mining, like, we're gonna need some kind of monetary system that has no central identity, because I think if one thing that we've learned, even if you just read the news in June 2026, right, that there's a lot of less trust into governments, and that's what Bitcoin solves, is that you have a system because of the miners that you don't need to trust anybody. And I think such a monetary system will be necessary, or actually has been necessary the whole time. We just somehow did a diversion into the fiat world and realized, oh, this is a bad idea. Let's go back to a system that is no central entity. And yeah, and so that's why I think Bitcoin mining is inevitable, that it will become the global standard for money, because it's a decentralized system where nobody can tell you if you're allowed to transact. Nobody can check if you have transacted or not. And that's what the Bitcoin miners in the end allow us to do.
It's wild. It's crazy to think even how people used to Google all the time, Google everything, and that's how you search. And you're like, okay, I trust that answer because I searched it on Google. But now people ask AI questions and that's their new Google, just, you know, search. So now asking people or AI about money and it's talking about Bitcoin, that is sort of a mirror of humanity. So it's going to be what we will be using. And the other thing is, when it came down to when Bitcoin came out and how this problem was solved, it wasn't just a computational problem that just it was almost it's crazy of me to think about the timing of when the white paper came out because of that global financial crisis that was happening in 2008. And also how the problem that was solved was what the Byzantine generals' problem is. So could you explain that?
Yes. Yeah. So the Byzantine generals' problem is basically, how do you communicate through a channel that is insecure? So let's say you and I want to communicate again. I want to send money from one to the other. In the Byzantine general, the problem was is that he had there was a battlefield, and there were multiple fronts that he had to coordinate. So there's like one team versus the other team, and his team was split up. Now, how do you communicate information from one team to the other, basically making sure that the information along the way does not get altered or leaked, because they had to coordinate. They had to decide, when do we all attack at the same time? Mm-hmm. And that has been in technology for the longest time a really complex problem, because a lot of times people just solved it with trusting, right? The Byzantine general could have just have said, well, okay, I choose my best people that I trust that they will be the fastest and just on a horse to get from one A to B. But there was never really 100% guarantee that this person along the way gets killed, or they turn to something else, right? Or they change the message. And
or what
Bitcoin,
if they jump the gun like a racer at a race, like at a starting
correct.
Line, and when they take off, then it's like, okay, if these people were to attack a village or something, and then the one person goes in too early, then they could get annihilated before the other two. I don't know,
exactly.
Something like that.
Correct. And so it's basically, how do I communicate securely through an insecure channel where I do not own the underlining system? And that's basically what we're doing, right? I'm sending value from me to you, Stacy, through the internet, which by default, for anybody that has ever like seen how dangerous the internet can be, like there's attackers, there's viruses, there's malware all the time. And we obviously have tools to prevent this, right? With firewalls and antivirus, but you never have 100% guarantee. And so how can I do, though, guarantee that the money or the value from me to you arrives? And Bitcoin has the whole thing, right? With this decentralized system, having the 10-minute blocks, having this dice rolling, which is the hashing, and having a system where every node can verify each other's data. That's how we basically can do this. And that's actually what brought me to Bitcoin in the very early days, because the internet until that time was all about copying each other's data. Like Napster was at the time the hot thing. The fact that I can just, that one person can buy a CD, rape the music, and then give it to everybody for free was one of the innovations that the internet allowed us to do. And now Satoshi came and said, I invented a system that I can transfer value, and even everybody in the world can see that transaction. They cannot steal it. That was the thing, like, wait, how does this work? But as we just learned, right, it has to do with encryption, it has to do with hashing, and this global synchronization of such a system. Can I transfer value to somebody else without anybody stealing it and making sure that I don't own it anymore after I send it to you?
See, and that's the fascinating thing also, because you think about this, your idea is such a great point, because people think the internet is a scary place. I have clients at my salon that still don't want to input their credit card info because they don't want to secure an appointment because they're afraid of putting their info online with the credit card. So I'm like, wow, okay. So I guess just call and see if we answer, because we don't really, everything's done online now. But I'm like, okay. And so they don't trust their info on the computer because they know how data can be stolen.
Yeah.
And people have their identity stolen. People, you know, use their information and their spend money on their card, whatever it is. So it's a system that already isn't trusted by so many. And Bitcoin doesn't have those same problems. So
yes.
When people worry about Bitcoin and, oh, it's money on the internet, that sounds scary. It's like, yeah, but the only problem is when a scammer, which is the same thing they do in a million other different systems in the world right now, if they were to trick you into revealing your seed phrase, or if you were to not wisely store your seed phrase on an online device like a phone or a computer, and they were able to get into that thing and take it from because you stored it there. You shouldn't. But those are ways that the human error and, you know what I mean, being able to get stolen from because you, it's not Bitcoin that was manipulated or nobody got info off of Bitcoin itself that allowed you to get hacked. It's you either giving up your information willingly, well, not knowingly, I guess, you know, just being tricked, you know. So it's just a crazy thought to think that that is what Satoshi solved. And that is, I mean, I don't know, it's huge. It's, I mean, thinking about what Napster did and then thinking about what this is massive.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. And but you are bringing up a good point, right? So this is technically by itself an extremely safe system, or it's one of the most safest system that we know. As humans, we generated. It's actually also one, at least beside the internet itself, it's probably one of the biggest machine, the most decentralized machine that were in terms of like usage of power that we have ever built as humans that all work together on one problem. However, there's still the human in that whole thing. And correct, right? If you have a seed phrase and you unfortunately give that seed phrase to somebody else, the Bitcoin network can protect you from it. There are ways, right? There are ideas where the Bitcoin community together tries to do things, and actually some of them are really, really close. One of them that I'm super excited in is like the whole vaulting idea that, for example, I can say like that specific Bitcoin can only be sent to maybe 3 or 5 other addresses, but not to anybody. Or there's a way that I can claw back, right? So that a transaction just is announced and then like it's not only for 10 minutes in the mempool, but it's actually for 2 or 3 weeks in like a limbo state. And during that time, I can undo the transaction. That's one of the things we're thinking about. Or some other people talking about like a valve so that, let's say I have 10 Bitcoin in a Bitcoin wallet address, and if I want to send it, I can only send like a tenth of a Bitcoin every single day. So it will take me like 100 days to empty the whole thing. So there are a couple of ideas. None of them exist right now. But still, right, these are just basically patches to solve the human's problem.
The human problem, yes.
The human, unfortunately, can be physically assaulted, or they can just also be social engineered that they hand out the system. But actually for that, I always tell people, like, look, if you go back and read history books about electricity, when electricity became and like we started to install electricity in people's houses, there were people who were very afraid that said, like, this will destroy humanity, right? Because it's so dangerous. Because it's correct, right? I can literally take a fork within myself, and I wouldn't even need to move, and I could probably execute myself right now at this podcast. Like, there's a possibility that I can do this right now. But still, we accepted this risk, right? We've learned as humans, we learned how to handle this risk. Like, we make the outlet and a cover. Like, I have young kids, so like you cover them all up, or you maybe even remove them altogether until you say, okay, now it's safe again to install them. And so I think that's what people also don't realize, or like, yes, we just look at this Bitcoin thing and it seems like, oh, this is dangerous. I will never learn this. But then at the same time, right, we have 110 volts around us all the time. If I take my fork in the wrong place, I'll kill myself. Or the same with cars, right? Like, we drive multiple ton vehicles at each other all the time. And it's sure, there are accidents, I'm not saying, and it's horrible that people die on the streets. But as a whole thing, we accept it as a society. We gain so much from traveling faster through cars than looking at each individual cases. And I think that's just what with Bitcoin is also going to happen, right? Right now, it's technology. People don't know how it understands. That's why I'm doing this. I'm trying to explain more and more people about how this mining stuff works. And then overall, and also through generations, and we see this as well, that younger generations are a lot more open towards this technology. Mm-hmm. And I think there is this saying, like, revolutions happen one death at a time. So unfortunately, that's obviously also true, is that as generations become more used to the internet, they grow up with it, the same is going to happen with Bitcoin as well. That at one point, we're going to look back, and like you and I can look back and say to the days like where there were no cars or where there was no electricity, how could we have lived there? I do believe that my probably grandchildren already will say, how could they have lived without Bitcoin? Like, this, I cannot imagine this world. And maybe they will find this podcast and listen back to it and all laugh at us. So who knows?
I love this. That's why I love doing the podcast too, because it's like a time capsule of our thoughts.
Yeah.
So, and people can go back and look at it and be like, wow, they were right. Or they can go back and be like, look what people were thinking. Well, all I could think is they were right. But so I'm just thinking that they're just looking back, thinking that we're, when the last Bitcoin is mined, this episode will still be out there. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, again, I'm not centralizing my podcast to just YouTube. I'm putting it in multiple spots, you know, so if anything were to have, like, but I'm just saying someday somebody could come back and hear these thoughts back when we were earning 3.5 Bitcoin per, you know, per lottery, per block mine.
Yeah.
So it's just a crazy thought. But just thinking about what you were saying about the, you know, the danger of, I was thinking about the danger of the outlets and electricity, and it's just such a crazy thought just to think that people, my God, I'm so ADD. I'm like, I had such an, you were just blowing my mind right there with that conversation. Cause it's just so true that people didn't, you know, they didn't understand the stuff. They thought it was scary. And, and it's just something that it's so safe. You know, this whole system is so safe, and it's not, I think I was thinking about what humans build, because humans build solutions to things like, here it is. So when I was transacting in Bitcoin at first, you know, so I got into it around 2020. So I was thinking, as long as somebody knows how to use a QR code, they can send Bitcoin back and forth, right? And everyone's using QR codes now for everything. So whether you're an older person or not, you understand, you see a QR code, you know how to scan it. That's how you send Bitcoin. The thing is, I think when I was learning about it, there were multiple chains and sending this or that or trading it for something else. And everyone thought, okay. And you would try to send, and you know, this didn't specifically happen to me with Bitcoin, but I tried sending some other currency somewhere and it gets lost, you know, along the shuffle. And you're like, what happened to it? Or you tried converting something. And that's why Bitcoin only, that is the way I roll, you know. But when I was learning, I was trying out some of this stuff. And now what I see is the way that people build tools for that human error and the mistakes that people make is that when you try to transact a Bitcoin address and you're trying to send Lightning, it says, that's not a valid address. But then you switch it over to Lightning, goes, okay, yeah, that works.
Yep.
So it's like not allowing you to accidentally send it into the void and never recover it, because they can recognize that it's not an address that you should send it to. So they're letting you know right there in the app, don't try to press send because it won't work. Like, use a different thing.
It's obviously, right, like I've been in technology now since at least 25 years, and that's usually how things are and develop, that the people that actually come up with the idea are usually not the specialists in usability. And so, yeah, the first versions of everything works from a technology point of view, and for the people that built it, it makes total sense for them. But for the other 7.9 billion people in the world, like they look at this and like, what do you expect me to do now? But that's where it's really cool. Like, that's, for example, I'm super excited about Square, Cash App, and Block. And like, because these are companies that think about every single day, how do I automate this transaction, right? At a cash register, what do I show? Like, they're debating for hours of like what to show on a screen and when, and different currencies and all that stuff. The same also online. And these companies are starting to think now, how do we integrate Bitcoin? And it's interesting to see that from a Bitcoin point of view, we always yell at them. It's like, just enable it everywhere. Like, why don't you do this? And it's like, that's a really, really hard problem. Like, how do you tell somebody that's never used Bitcoin that they trust in it? Because that's also humans. If the first interaction is bad, usually it takes like another 20 good interactions to counter that bad experience. And so, yeah, these companies, they are in the business of making these things extremely simple. And that's like one of you, what you're saying, right? Like, in the beginning, yeah, we had different Bitcoin addresses and Lightning and Cashew and whatever. And now it seems to look more and more that we just have one QR code. And behind is all the information. It doesn't matter if you now use on-chain Lightning, Cashew, or whatever else will come. and just to make it a lot simpler. And that's, by the way, this is the same also in mining. It happens the same, right? Like when I started, I literally had to buy a miner. Like I had to learn how to connect to it. It had no Wi-Fi and it was like half of it was in Chinese. And now I can literally buy a BitX. I can plug it in. It shows me again a QR code. It connects to the Wi-Fi and to my real Wi-Fi and boom, it's done.
So
it's so easier to buy a dice, to go back to that analogy, and play in this global world of dice rolling, then it was just like already 5 years ago, it was a lot, lot harder. And I think that's just becoming a lot easier, where maybe that we don't even have to set up things anymore and you just connect it to the Wi-Fi and it finds information itself, all that stuff.
That's such a great point. I'm glad you brought it back to the mining too and not just sending Bitcoin back and forth because that has changed so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is just something that I just love the way that you come back to the mining and, you know, bring my brain back because it is all over the place. And I have so many thoughts and, you know, so many things. But this is really informative and it's such a great conversation. And I think that hopefully this helped people understand mining a bit more. And one more thing about those dice rolling devices. It is astronomically small of a chance to win that number. But when people play the Powerball, I've actually ChatGPT'd or done AI on this to think what the difference is. And with the Powerball, you're spending however much money, dollars at a time. I don't know how much people spend on that stuff. But every 3-4 days, somebody wins it. You know, they win this huge jackpot, right? So you win it. Right now, the Bitcoin jackpot's smaller, but it happens every 10 minutes. So if you even have one device competing against, there's still a small chance, but it happens every 10 minutes. So there's a drawing constantly.
Yeah.
And people have won, you know, the Bitcoin rewards.
Correct. And the other thing is, like specifically a BitX, right? It doesn't use a lot of energy. So you will, if you plug one of these in, you will not see a change on your power bill because if you go shower and you reheat water, it actually uses like the same amount of energy is used in the next 20 minutes than the Bitcoin, the BitX, let's say if you buy a BitX, uses the whole month. So it's tiny, it's not loud, and it looks cool. Like, I mean, I have one here. So like for the people on the video, it just looks also like a cool thing that you can put on your desk. So I really encourage anybody that is interested in mining, just jump in, like get a BitX, configure it, see that you have different configurations, figure out, like learn about the pools. And as you mentioned already, like if you're stuck, just ask AI. Like it knows a lot about these things. We are now building open source hardware in Bitcoin mining and we're using AI every single day to solve problems ourselves, even as the people that are like at the forefront of building this hardware and software. So I think it has never been a better time to learn about mining and just jump in and play around with it. And like you said, it's a tiny chance, but it's bigger than winning the Powerball lottery. So who knows? Yeah. Maybe you will find a Bitcoin block and get 3 Bitcoin plus a bit of change on top of it. So it is possible.
I'm just thinking about if I could have AI make a B-roll for me with a trillion sides on a dice. Like I just can get that image out of my mind, even though you can't really think of that, you know, but that's such a cool thought. But thank you so much. This has been so fascinating. And I look forward to hearing more from you. It'd be great to have you come back one day and explain some more Bitcoin topics.
I'm happy to come back anytime. Like I said, it's technology, right? It's, I think we're going to have to teach everybody. If we expect that the whole world will use this, we have to take away the fear. And I think the fear, you can take away the fear with a lot of understanding. And that's why I'm spending a lot of time in just explaining people if they are interested to listen. I did stop trying to force people to listen to me because that doesn't work. But if they are interested, so yeah, happy to join and talk about anything else. Like there's a lot more in the mining that we didn't look at all, from pools to solo mining to how share counting works and whatever. So I'm happy to come back and do some more. So
thank you. Yes, let us know in the comments too if there is any other topic you'd like to cover, but those are great topics and that would be amazing to have because there is so much. And it, again, once you understand it, it's simple, but it's nice to break it down and even remember myself because I feel like it's been a little bit of time now since I was discovering Bitcoin. So it's nice to take a trip back and really learn this stuff. So thank you so much and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.